you invited me to check out your new ride? This isn't what I was picturing.
Listen, Greg, I've had it with the wussy Nissan Versus. The Komatsu VD355A bulldozer is who I really am as a commuter.
Well, why didn't you just get a Hummer?
It's funny you should say that. Do you see that green Hummer over there?
That one?
He never knew what hit him.
Actually, the Hummer is rolling down the hill toward a baseball diamond.
Those kids are gonna get out of the way. How else are they gonna develop reflexes?
I'm just wondering what kind of miles per gallon this thing gets.
We don't really say it that way. We say liters per hour, and the answer is 27. Look, Greg, I don't feel like being lectured with all your Bernie Sanders self-righteousness. We all know what the future is. Giant hurricanes and homicidal robots. I just want to squeeze a little joy out of life before that happens, okay? What are you going to do, tell Bernie? You're going to tell on me, Greg?
Kyone, watch out. That's Bernie standing there on the New Haven green.
Walk it off, commie. Let's get this baby up on the highway and crank her up to 7.9 miles per hour.
Kyone, pull over. This just isn't right. A piece of heavy equipment doesn't give you the right to be a destructive monkey head.
You are probably right, Greg. But as a woman, I felt helpless and vulnerable for many years. It's been really hard, Greg, really hard. And, you know, maybe that's why I made this crazy choice.
Well, I'm glad we could talk about this.
Gotcha! You have been so totally served. Watch out, world! Here comes Demolition Girl!
Kyone, that's a toll booth!
Talk about an easy pass, am I right?
Please drop me off.
Not until you listen to this show about bulldozers. And now, his college nickname was Stump Grinder, Colin McEnroe.
Welcome to Our Bulldozers Ourselves. We're going to talk about bulldozers in lots of different contexts here. And sometimes bulldozers will be kind of a proxy for other kinds of heavy equipment. Sometimes other kinds of heavy equipment will be a proxy for bulldozers. We're going to talk about what they've meant out in the real world. We're going to talk about what they mean in our minds. We're going to talk about why, in fact, we sort of cathect with them at a very young age and sometimes never decathect. Sometimes still want to play with them as adults. And it turns out there are people who do that as a sort of a vacation. They go and they get to operate heavy equipment. You'll hear about that towards the end of the show today. We got a lot of ground to cover here, but we do want to begin with that first bond, the early bond that we make with a bulldozer or something like a bulldozer. Joining us now is Kate McMullen, who writes children's books, including a number of picture books about transportation and construction vehicles. She's an executive producer of Amazon Prime's animated series, The Stinky and Dirty Show, which is like really one of the great titles of all time. I can't believe that nobody thought of it before. But anyway, so Kate McMullen, first of all, welcome to this conversation.
Thank you. Great to be here, Colin.
And then let's talk about this. Okay, so you kind of got started with one of our proxy vehicles, right? It wasn't a bulldozer. It wasn't a payloader. It wasn't a front loader. It was a garbage truck that really kind of got you on the road. Yeah. You became a garbage truck groupie.
I pretty much did.
And this led to other books about equipment, about backhoes and tugboats. And ordinarily, this would be just a peculiar habit that Kate McMullen has, except that children really, there's a huge audience for this. There's an avid audience for this. I think we know that if you try to raise a child, particularly a little boy, and although you may want to dispute some of the sex role stuff here, but particularly a little boy, and you never mention bulldozers, you never point out a bulldozer or a backhoe or a payloader or anything like that as you're passing by. If you do your best to keep this child isolated from heavy equipment, this child will still want heavy equipment. He or she will want toys that are heavy equipment. He or she will. So first of all, I'm sure that's part of the feedback that you get from your audience.
Yeah, when I had my daughter and a stroller, my friends who had boys in their strollers, they would go to the construction sites. That's where the kids wanted to go. And they'd peep through those little holes and they'd watch holes being dug. And, the moms were going, okay, are you done enough? And the boys never got enough. I don't want to stereotype kids by gender, but we got our daughter a truck when she was little, and she wrapped it in a blanket and rocked it. So
let's talk about what that means. I mean, not what that means, but what this interest in heavy equipment is all about. Do you have any theories about this? I mean, I suppose you don't get like detailed comment threads from 4 and 5 year olds. I'm assuming that you don't, you know, they don't write you, you know, 5-page letters either. But I mean, do you have a sense of what's going on here? I have a series of irresponsible Norman O. Brown type theories, which I will allow you to shoot down. But first of all, I was wondering, do you have a theory?
Well, I think it's power. You know, yes. It's sort of what, like why they like dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. They're big and powerful. And well, with dinosaurs, they're extinct. So that helps them be safe. The vehicles aren't dangerous. And I think they stand in for, like, could I do that? Could I dig a big hole? And it's a vicarious pleasure of seeing how they work.
Now, we could go a little deeper and we could say, well, why are they interested in things like a garbage truck or something that pushes dirt around? Well, most of your audience has recently gone through a period or is in the middle of a period where other people, outside powers, have developed an unhealthy and totalitarian interest in the child's own waste products, right? I mean, suddenly there's people telling you, no, you can't poop there. You can't poop in your pants. You got to poop over there. We're going to take it from over there. We're going to put it someplace else. So you've been through all that. I mean, you've had to surrender for a while your control in the name of achieving your own control. But you had to surrender your own independence and your own volitional defecation to higher powers. Some of the fascination has to be, oh, well, you know, I could actually own equipment that moves this stuff around, you know?
I don't think I'm going to shoot this theory down. I think there's something to it. And I think the title, I Stink, kids love to say, I stink.
There's liberation.
When they stink.
It's liberation. I do think that's true, that your childhood, as wonderful as we try to make childhood, there are oppressive aspects to it. You don't get to decide when you go to bed. You don't get to decide where you poop. You don't get to decide whether or not you go for that car ride. There's a lot of stuff you don't get to decide. So there's something about these things that are bigger than your parents' car.
They could take on your parents, huh?
Yeah. I think there's, you know, at least the dream of somehow or other superseding your basically powerless environment.
I'm liking it.
Yeah, you're not fighting it off anyway.
I am not. I can see that. When I wrote, I stink, and then I'm dirty, and I'm mighty, and these things, this kind of analysis doesn't really enter into it until afterwards.
No, the artist doesn't know. The artist is unconscious.
Exactly.
Yeah, you as an artist are unconscious. Then the critic, I'm sort of the Clement Greenberg of your work. I come along and talk about it and find all kinds of meaning that you did not intentionally put in it. But then I'm assuming also that we should talk about the Stinky and Dirty Show, because these are kind of the adventures of two pieces of equipment, right? This allows the child to project fully into a world, a narrative world for heavy equipment.
That's right. And Stinky and Dirty in the show are kids. It's a little garbage truck who says, maybe I'll be a flatbed truck when I grow up. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't make any sense, but it's funny. So they are always trying to solve problems, these little kids. And they are, you know, they call on bigger vehicles to help them out sometimes. They can, you know, access these bigger, stronger vehicles. But basically, they solve the problems. So that's a powerful feeling, too.
So I'll give you my third and final critical analysis, my theory about this, which is, and this sort of ties into other things that we're going to be talking about today with some of our other guests. The other thing that you can say about heavy equipment is it's essentially the domestication of war equipment, right? A bulldozer is a tank without a gun on it. It's a domesticated version of an instrument of destruction. So to whatever degree the child knows or senses that he has destructive impulses, it's an invitation to sublimate them. Like the worst thing a bulldozer is ever going to do is knock over a building. And I'm wondering if there's something there too, you know, that part of the child's acclimation to his or her world is to understand, well, you can't really be a tank. That wouldn't be good. You'd really be hurting people, but you could be a bulldozer.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, it may be that bulldozers and wrecking balls cater to that impulse. Like, they like to knock down the block towers. Let's destroy it. But I think there are a lot of vehicles that really don't have that element, mm-hmm. like a concrete mixer.
Yes.
Just going around and around and around.
True.
And then I think they have a lot of bodily, they're a lot of constructed by our own bodily functions. So kids can see that. in them, and I think that's one thing they like. I'm not sure about, like, if it can't be a tank, I can be a bulldozer, because I don't know if they know about tanks.
Well, first of all, I would never respect you if you agreed with all my opinions. So I think that was good that you put up some resistance there. And certainly as they get older, they'll discover the ways in which their digestive system truly resembles a cement mixer. But that comes at, like, in your 60s, really.
No, I'm not sure. I think they get it. I think on some subliminal level, they know.
All right. Well, Kate McMullen, we're very excited about not only your books, but obviously The Stinky and Dirty Show, was the alternative title for the Colin McEnroe Show. We just decided to go in a different direction. So congratulations, and we wish you nothing but success and the ability to move large amounts of dirt around.
Thank you, Colin. It was fun to talk to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, I wanted to ask Kate about that sort of demilitarization idea, the idea that a bulldozer is essentially a tank without a gun, partly because of our main guest here today, who is Francesca Ammann, the author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Postwar Landscape. Her book is out. It's the reason we're doing this show. And even though what she's just listened to may have completely persuaded her, she shouldn't have agreed to do the show. But in fact, there's a segue from this to that. There are several segues. We just talked about bulldozers as a child's image of liberation. We're now going to talk about bulldozers as an adult image of oppression. But first, I think we need to talk about the kind of the military connection here. Francesca Ammann, first of all, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you.
And in your book, Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Postwar Landscape, you don't start with the postwar. You start with the war, right? The war at which point, that was the time when we sort of figured out as a nation, as a military power, hey, we're really good, really good, better than we even thought at moving dirt around and breaking stuff and demolishing stuff and clearing landscapes and knocking down groves of coconut trees and building airstrips. I mean, we just kind of discovered this untapped and subsequently enhanced capacity for all that stuff, right?
That's right. The war, I think, was a really integral piece of the story of the bulldozer, which, of course, precedes the war as well. But during World War II, particularly on the Pacific front, bulldozers and other construction equipment become really important in clearing away trees and dirt to make way for bases, airfields, highways as well. They become important tools, weapons as well, even in battling the enemy in some cases. And the machine emerges from the conflict, having proven its worth and its power. And then it comes home and remakes the American landscape in the post-war period.
Because we developed this extra capacity, too. We made a lot of these machines. We made them bigger. We made them better. There were a lot of things for them to do. And you know, there's a moment in your description of World War II that reminded me of, back in the 90s, somebody was wooing me for a job in Las Vegas. And they said, well, you know, nothing ever gets painted or anything around here. If something gets old, we just tear it down and build something else. You know, that kind of notion of the disposable landscape. Well, there's this incredible moment in your book where you describe they're making this essentially an air highway to Tokyo. They're building landing strips on island after island. And some military officer says, I should let you tell the story, about what happens when a bulldozer breaks.
Basically, they just bring up another one. There's two sides to that story, actually. One is that they're almost indestructible, right? They're building the highway. I think it's out in Hawaii, this incident you're talking about. And they are having trouble getting them down the hill. And they just decide to roll them down the hill. And you know what? They survive. They're these really hardy machines. And so they can take a lot and they can still do a lot at the end of that. And then the other side of it, as I said, is that they had plenty of them. The production, as you mentioned, was ramped up for the war. And although it was really hard to buy a new bulldozer at home, say you wanted to build a highway back in the United States, all the equipment was going out to the Pacific and the European front as well. And so these manufacturing facilities had a lot of capacity to then be reused after the war was through.
Yeah. Actually, the story that I was thinking was C.B. Adolf Pisani says one of them, talking about the D-8 Caterpillars, the kind of quintessential World War II bulldozer, one of them would break down. They didn't bother fixing it. Bulldoze it off in the ocean, get it out of the way so another one could go to work. So they actually bulldozed bulldozers into the ocean because it would be just easier to bring another one in. That's how many of them they had. So very quickly, we're going to go to a break here in just a second, but to kind of set up the premise of the book, the part of the premise of the book is you know, we came out of World War II with this unexpended capacity for doing this kind of thing. And so our attentions turned to our domestic environment. And suddenly you had the building of a huge interstate highway system, and you had urban renewal. You had these forces in which the capacity of the bulldozer to do something similar but different was unleashed. I don't know if you have a way of saying that in a nutshell.
Well, basically, the machine transforms from military weapon to tool of urban planning in the post-war period. So you have this transformation, same machine, but different activities. And as you said, there's three big ways that it reshapes the post-war landscape. In cities, for urban renewal, demolishing buildings. In suburbs, clearing land for large-scale tract development. And then in cities, suburbs, and rural landscapes, moving dirt for the creation of 46,000 miles of interstate highways.
And we'll talk a little bit more in one of the other segments about using New Haven as a case study. But one of the things that's pretty clear there is that, I thought one of the more, chilling is not the right word, but troubling moments in the New Haven chapter of the book was one in which some of the people who were relocated so that their neighborhoods could be demolished so that something else could come in would go back quite a long time later, sometimes years later, and the thing that was going to come in wasn't there yet. That the capacity to demolish and clear the landscape had outstripped the ability to bring the thing in that supposedly had to be made way for.
That's right. There was often a real rush to clear away and make that blank slate for new construction, but all too often it took a very long time for those clean slates to be developed. So very often you'd have parking lots as interim uses, and they lasted for quite long, longer than the cities wanted because those weren't good economic uses of the land. And they were sad uses of the land for those people who had formerly, called those places home. So the pace of activity, the destruction, it took longer than they wanted sometimes, too, but was relatively quick, and they wanted to get that done. But the new construction dragged out for quite a long time.
I mean, as you point out in the New Haven chapter, although it was often very sad to lose neighborhoods, and it happened up here in Hartford, Front Street, which was this kind of quintessential sort of pre-World War II Italian-type neighborhood, the kind of thing you see in the beautiful early scenes in Godfather II, that got wiped away. Ethnic enclaves tended to be wiped away. Anything that somebody might call a ghetto might be wiped away. And obviously, there were tremendous amounts of loss when that happened. But as you point out, I mean, some of the people that you talked to said, on the other hand, whatever that American dream is, you know, that notion of the ranch house on the quarter acre lot, you know, that's where a lot of people went. A lot of people got lives that may have ultimately looked quite a bit better to them than, you know, the third floor walk up they were living in.
That's right. In physical terms, many of the people did receive better accommodations. And one of the, the act that really set this off, the Housing Act of 1949, an overarching goal, was better housing for everyone. And so you have people moved to the suburbs or around in the city, presumably to better accommodations. But what sociologists who followed up with these individuals found was that, physical improvement didn't necessarily lead to psychological and social improvement in these communities. Individuals had a hard time making friends, even years down the line, and they never recovered in a lot of ways from the root shock, as it's been termed, of being displaced. So physical conditions are definitely necessary, improved physical conditions, but the cost is those psychological and social consequences. And that's what we learned, I think, through the widespread example of urban renewal.
All right, so we're talking today about bulldozers, what they mean to kids, what they mean in the world of urban renewal, what a bulldozer even is, and we'll also talk about how bulldozers are actually used by some people recreationally. We'll talk about all that as we go along here. Quick break. We'll come back.
Bulldozer girl. Bulldozer girl. She'll push the dirt aside.
All right, we're back. We're talking about bulldozers. We're talking about them as what they really are, and also how we see them, what they've meant, how they are symbolic of the demolition and clearance of the post-war landscape, to steal the subtitle of Francesca Ammann's book, Bulldozer. We also do want to talk about what a bulldozer really is and what it is today. So joining us to be part of that conversation, and then we'll circle back to Francesca. We have quite a bit more to talk to Francesca about. But let's talk to Jason Annitzberger, who's project manager for Komatsu, America's intelligent machine control line of bulldozers and excavators. You heard in our introduction a reference to the Komatsu D355, I think, which is one of the state-of-the-art bulldozers, or maybe it isn't. Jason Annensberger, obviously everything's more high-tech than it used to be. So you grew up reading Mike Mulligan and the Steam Shovel, so did my son, but things don't really look so much like that anymore. What's a modern bulldozer like? What does it have that it didn't used to have?
Hey, Colin. Pleasure to be here. Yeah, I don't know. So if you had that impression from Mike Mulligan and the Steam Shovel, maybe you're thinking machines belching black smoke out of the exhaust or greasy palmed operators pulling heavy levers. Well, that's not really dozers anymore. Today we've got touchscreen displays like your smartphone or tablet, factory integrated into Komatsu dozers along with GPS positioning technology. So we're moving mountains of material with precisions of 30 millimeters or so, and the blade's controlled automatically to preloaded CAD 3D designs from the very first to very last pass. So quite a bit of a change.
And we also read, getting ready for the show, that you need experienced operators for bulldozers. Why would there not be as many experienced operators today as there were in the past?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it kind of varies by region. Of course, they had a financial crisis a couple years ago, and where the industry is at, it's just tough sometimes to find that experienced dozer hand. So that's where we really see a good opportunity with the technology, is that it opens the door for operators to be very productive in the machines, even if they are lacking, say, many, many years of experience. To do effective dozing manually, it does generally take a lot of experience, a good feel for the machine to interpret those motions, those sensations that you feel as you track along, into then controlling the blade to give you good accuracy. So that technology really is an aid and a replacement for that in some cases.
Although, yeah, I mean, it would seem to me that you would develop a certain skill set and a certain feel for what you're doing, a feel for the earth under the blade, a feel for what the blade is doing. Are you saying that ultimately that can be replaced by technology?
At the very least, augmented. So no doubt, experience helps you in the machine today. So today, if you doze it manually, a experienced operator is going to be more productive than an inexperienced operator. Now, you put those two individuals into one of these advanced dozers with added intelligence, an operator with years of experience is still going to be more productive than a person right off the street. So, but the benefit is that both of their games are getting improved. So the technology holds a benefit for them both. If you tried to jump in a dozer for the very first time, and try to make something, you're going to make a mess of it, no doubt about it.
So everything seems to be headed towards connectivity, to what we call roboticization, which could be anything that doesn't have a living operator right in it, drones, stuff like that. Is that what bulldozers are going to be too? Are they going to be operated from remote centers?
Yeah, so I guess I would say we're definitely seeing the trend of increased automation in construction equipment. Today there's autonomous haulage systems or basically large electric drive mining trucks that Komatsu makes that do not have operators in them, so fully autonomous. On the dozers today, we're not there. Basically, we have these systems that we've integrated into them, added this intelligence so that part of the machine operation is automated, but still we have the operator in the cab controlling the other aspects of the machine operation.
All right. Well, we've been talking to a representative here of Komatsu, one of the, really at this point, two big signature bulldozer companies. Jason Annensberger has been joining us from Komatsu. I have a Komatsu and a Caterpillar. I like the four-shift gearbox on the Komatsu. Sometimes I like the Caterpillar for the bigger engine, the 3D7.7 motor. But anyway, thanks so much. That's kilowatts, by the way. Thanks for joining us, Jason. We're going to swing back here, and I'm sorry for ping-ponging around so much, but we have a fundraising show today, so I have to sort of run the clock a little bit differently. Francesca Ammann is going to be with us the entire time. She's the author of Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Postwar Landscape. So Francesca, I'm going to kind of compress some of what you do in this fascinating New Haven chapter, where New Haven, in a kind of way disproportionate to its size and population, really participated in urban renewal. So, you know, the initial symbolology of that was wrecking balls and bulldozers. But, you know, after a few years, or maybe after a decade or more, that became a little less, slowly less fashionable, right? This notion of rehabilitation, of saving something, of moving Louis' Lunch, the famous hamburger place, that becomes more the symbol than knocking something down. What does it take for that mind shift to have to happen?
Well, a couple of things. First and foremost, I think, is the experience of implementing this widespread clearance approach and people starting to push back against that and saying, aren't there other ways that we can still maintain our communities? You know, different conversations that, you know, feed into legislation. In 1949, as I said, the Housing Act provides federal grants to subsidize the clearance of slums and other blighted, so-called blighted areas of cities. The federal government would pay two-thirds of the cost of that. So that was a great incentive to cities to put plans that were clearance-oriented into action. By 1954, they say, okay, you can start using some of that money for rehabilitation. And by 1966, you have the Historic Preservation Act, which is having its 50th anniversary this year, which really articulates this idea of let's see what we can save. And that's from people who care about buildings architecturally, people who have lived in the neighborhoods, who want to have a greater role and say in what their communities are going to be. So it's kind of a groundswell of different forces that lead to alternative approaches that maybe clearance alone isn't the only way to remake our cities. Maybe being modern doesn't mean just new buildings. Maybe preservation and rehabilitation can also be a part of that.
And in the book, you find the perfect pictorial symbol for that in the moving of Louis' Lunch, this archetypal hamburger place that even pretends at times, or contends, I guess maybe would be the way to say it, contends for the title of having invented and introduced the hamburger. So moving it instead of flattening it, it's a great symbol. It's the perfect image. We're talking to Francesca Ammann about bulldozers. We'll be talking more about bulldozers when we come back. If you like this crazy show, and by the way, yesterday some of you tried to call in and donate, and the phone bank in the Shire, we use Hobbits, was broken. So please, if you tried to donate yesterday and you couldn't, please call today. These nice people for the next few minutes are going to ask you to support this show that you love, this crazy show that does shows about bulldozers. All right, somehow today I wrote Kion Wolf's usual thank you script. Lost it or erased it. So I got to thank, first of all, the person producer of the show is Jonathan McNichol. When Francesca Ammann's book, Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Postwar Landscape, came in, we looked at each other and said, got to do this show. Jonathan's also working on a show right now about dinosaurs, so he is now officially 8 years old again. Greg Hill is handling the tweets for us at WNPR Colin. You heard him also in the intro. Kion Wolf, of course, is on the board making everything just sound great. Stephanie Reeve is on phones. It always turns out Betsy Kaplan did something. I don't know what she did with this show, but every time I think she didn't do something, it turns out she did. So thank you for whatever that is. The part of Bill Curry was played by Robert Urich, who actually appears in the movie Killdozer, this really terrible B movie about a bulldozer inhabited by a space alien thing situation. And of course, for show pages, articles, and videos of the Here and Now staff playing with their trucks, go to WNPR.org. We'll be back tomorrow with the news. Obviously, the death of Prince has kind of, I hope I'm not springing that on people, but it's obviously changed our landscape, and we're going to be talking about that. So here we go. We're back to the Bulldozer Show. I want to come back to Francesca Ammann and talk a little bit more about the cultural aspect of this, also very well covered in her book. So, Francesca, you know, a lot of the book is about the romance of the bulldozer, and then B, the way that romance turned into the the demolition and clearance, the destructive power of the bulldozer that was sometimes pretty hegemonically employed to dislocate old ethnic and racial enclaves, even gay and lesbian people, and the changing of the American landscape. But you also deal with the culture of this and how really our whole relationship, our psychological relationship with the bulldozer did change at a certain point, just in the same sense that it wasn't cool anymore to bulldoze Louis' Lunch. The bulldozers weren't quite as cool. I mean, they start turning up in movies like Fern Gully, you know, as things that are really kind of bad. Tell us a little bit more about that. How did our psychological relationship with this machine change?
A variety of things. As I said, kind of the lived experience of what it meant to bulldoze landscapes was very different than the very simple imagery planted in people's minds and believed in many cases, I'm sure, at the outset. So one of the officials behind Urban Renewal said at the outset of the program that, you know, this would be like armies of bulldozers smashing down acres of slums, and that this would be swift and clean and modernizing. And the reality of it was much more difficult, much dirtier, much slower, and much more damaging, as we've talked about a little bit. So the lived experience on its own starts to dismantle the the image of the machine. Also, the legacy of World War II dissipates as well. Coming out of the war, you have these really supportive stories about how bulldozers have figured into battles. This memory starts to fade as the war moves more distantly into our memory. Vietnam is a different kind of war, and associations with militarization are not nearly as positive as they had been with World War II. So you have that as well. And then even our cultural products start to transform, as you were mentioning, movies that depict bulldozers in a different light, that story of Killdozer. Artworks like earthworks artists who start digging holes in the dirt in the desert, and we start to question what's going on there. It's not all simple progress anymore. And even the children's books aren't all so celebratory. You don't just have friendly Benny the Bulldozer and Buster Bulldozer. You have stories about, young kids living in New York whose homes are being demolished and what that means to them and the nightmares they have about bulldozers coming and changing their domestic environments. All these things combine to take down that, all-encompassing positive view that I think is more popular at the outset of the post-war period.
Yeah, and it absolutely does seem to change. And there is actually, as you say, I think it's a 1944 story. Initially, it gets turned into a comic book, a graphic novel,
right,
kind of called Killdozer. But then it gets turned into this very disappointing movie. I watched some of Killdozer, and it's not even as good as it should be. It's just not even a good Mystery Science Theater thing, but it's Killdozer. It's about a bulldozer that is taken over by some kind of alien space life. Although, how something that goes 1 or 2 miles an hour couldn't easily be walked away from is a little hard for me to understand. They don't really go very fast, those bulldozers.
If you contrast that with the movie The Fighting Seabees, for example, that John Wayne is in during, right at the outset of this period, and the celebrated way that these machines kind of win the day, it's a very different depiction of what these machines are all about and how they relate to patriotism and progress. So they're great contrast just in the cultural media itself.
Did you, by any chance, in your peregrination since then, run into the story of Marvin Heemeyer of Granby, Colorado? Do you know about him?
Yes. He kind of takes off around town and starts destroying things with a bulldozer run amok, something like that.
Yeah, he armors up a bulldozer. He kind of returns it to its old militarized past. This was 2004 in Granby, Colorado. He didn't kill anybody. He killed himself at the end of this rampage. But I think he would rampage for about 2 hours, and there were SWAT teams following him around, shooting at his bulldozer and not making a dent in it and everything. But it's kind of like almost this residual last gasp of that notion. Anyway, that the bulldozer could be used that way.
And that it could get out of control, which is kind of what happens during the post-war period, too. Although it's not, armored and running around town, in certain ways, we lose control of the simple idea of clearance equals progress. And it starts to get away from us in a way. And it gets reined in by these other pieces of legislation, for example, that temper the places and ways that we can implement clearance. It still happens, but there are a lot more checks and balances in place to make sure that that's really what we want to do and that the people that are affected are adequately compensated.
Well, the minute we started talking about doing the show, my mind went to a couple of different places. And one of those two places was I thought there's got to be something out there for people who are not heavy equipment operators but have never outgrown their childlike love of this stuff and would just get off so much, would just find it so intriguing to be able to use one of those, like on a vacation or some kind of corporate retreat or something. There has to be something like this. And it turns out, well, actually there is. We're going to talk now to the person who really kind of specializes in that, and that is Randy Stinger. He's the founder and CEO of Extreme Sandbox, also a great name. So first of all, Randy Stinger, welcome to this conversation, and explain what Extreme Sandbox is. I've kind of given away some of the story, but tell us what you guys do.
Yeah, and thanks for having us on the show. So Extreme Sandbox, we're a heavy equipment adventure company that basically lets people play on construction equipment. So we really have found a way to kind of turn that the curiosity on this equipment from that, you know, from being a roadside work zone curiosity into an informative, exciting, hands-on experience for people.
And so who does this? Who winds up electing to spend, I don't know, is it a day, is it 2 days? I mean, well, first of all, how big a package is this?
Yeah, we do it. Usually there at most would be a day. But we've seen our clients, you know, we started the concept about 4 years ago in Minnesota. And, you know, initially we honestly didn't, we just tested it out. We didn't know if it would take off. And then we started part-time on weekends only, and the business just blew up. And what we've really seen is that all ages, all demographics, we go down to 14 years old. We go all the way up to, we've had 92-year-olds in the cab. So I think, you know, good diversity of men and women have done it. So, you know, I think everyone's got that little inner child in them from when they were a kid. We see this stuff every day. We want to play in our big sandbox. And, you know, that's really what we're able to do. And most of our, I would say most of our clients spend about an hour to 2 hours out on site, maybe just doing one piece initially. We run excavators, bulldozers, and wheel loaders. But they'll usually, you know, we have all day packages if they want. There's a lot of different options we have.
You know what I hate is when the 92-year-old gets to the bulldozer, puts the left turn signal on, and just leaves it on. So, is there
going to
be?
You don't want to say anything. By the way, the 92-year-old and the bulldozer with that, don't say anything because he's in a 20-ton bulldozer and yeah. he'll
True.
Punch you.
Exactly. He's doing a great job no matter what.
Yes.
So, are there dates? Are there proposals? Are there things like that? I mean, is there a romance to any of this?
I'm sorry, are there dates?
Do people go on dates, you know? I mean.
Oh, dates, yeah. I have couples. Yeah. Totally. We, you know, we actually started, you know, initially we only had one of each piece, and then we quickly realized after a year or two, people really want to do this in pairs. So we now run everything we run is in pairs. And the beauty of that is we can teach two people at the same time, you know, it's the same equipment, and we call it dueling adventures.
Yeah.
So we have dueling excavators or dueling bulldozers where we can actually have you kind of compete head to head. The great thing is you're on headsets. We're all talking on the same channel. So as a, you know, if we have a husband, wife in there, they can be heckling each other or brothers or something like that. It's really a perfect activity for that.
Right. My mother always said, never go to bed until the two of you have shut down the bulldozer. Is that the most, what's the most popular piece of equipment? What do people want to use?
The excavator is probably our flagship. That's probably the most popular, you know, second with the bulldozer. But the reality is, you know, people ask us when they call, you know, which piece to pick, and I tell people they're like my kids. I can't pick a favorite. They're all the same. But, you know, the excavator is probably one of the primary in the construction industry, seen the most, and people want to get up there and dig. But after I put people, if they do multiple pieces, you know, I usually get a pretty even split 50-50 on the bulldozer and excavator and which one they enjoyed more.
And I understand that this has now become kind of a team-building corporate retreat kind of thing too, right? This is one of your big markets?
Yep. Yeah, and that's really what we kind of morphed into is the first year we just did, you know, it was weekends only. It was the, you know, husband, wives, the families, you know, more of a tourism kind of draw. And then within the first year or two, we started getting contacts from, you know, large companies we're in the Minneapolis, St. Paul area. And that's really where the light went on for us as we saw the lack in the industry for corporate team building activities. That was something unique. A lot of these big companies they're sick of doing the golf outing or the, you know, maybe bowling or there's so many other things that they've done so many times. This really is a truly unique activity. And we not only can we play with the equipment, we can also do scenario-based training. So we may actually take like an executive team. And in those instances, it's not just about playtime. It's about how do you use the equipment to accomplish a task as a team. And that really is something very unique that no one in the world is doing with construction equipment.
This is an amazing story, and Randy Stinger, the company, is called Extreme Sandbox. Look them up on the web. Do your next corporate retreat there. If you get Yahoo, if they book you, be careful. They may want to, like, bury the whole executive staff or something like that. Don't let them do that. And obviously, friends do not let friends bulldoze drunk. So as we come to the end here, Francesca, and obviously that story is not the story that you're telling. But in a way, it kind of is that, you know, it's like the Wild West. When there wasn't a Wild West anymore, there were Wild West shows. And then gradually, the whole thing kind of shrunk down into this almost recreational and entertainment model as opposed to a historical reality. Is that what you see happening to the story that you're telling under the title Bulldozer?
I guess so. You know, where I stop the story is really in the 70s when urban renewal comes to a close and the Highway Act isn't building more highways and things are starting to change. Preservation is a bigger part of it. But obviously the bulldozer rolls on and they're part of building and unbuilding today. And we see it very active still in places like Detroit that are demolishing a lot of vacant buildings. So the story continues, but it's more isolated in its application. And it lives on, as you say, in the entertainment world and in our cultural forms. These children's books continue. But it's not the everyday reality as it was in so many cities across the country in those early post-war decades.
Well, also the dream changed, right? I mean, what we hear now is that millennials are moving back to cities. They want to live in, you know, maybe some of the kinds of places that were raised back in the 1950s, they may want to write. You know, they may want to live in a much more rehabbed and improved version of that. But the actual notion of the American dream that was behind the ascendance of the bulldozer is changing even as we speak.
That's true, but there is a continued interest in living in the suburbs, and sprawl continues, and the bulldozer and other machines like that are really integral to the moving of dirt and the creation of building pads for those purposes, too. So it's not really entirely in the past. It does continue, but is operating in slightly different ways.
All right. Well, you'll never completely bury the bulldozer. Thanks so much, Francesca Ammon. It's a great book, Bulldozer, Demolition and Clearance of the Postwar Landscape. We've barely scratched the surface there. And so let's bring the music up as we say thank you. And thank you especially to Jonathan McNichol, who produced this show, and to Kion Wolf for engineering, Greg Hill, for tweeting for us at WNPR Colin and appearing in the intro. And once again, people are going to come on here and ask you maybe to support the kind of programming that you like. So absolutely support the kind of programming that you like when they ask you to. It does help our show specifically if you donate while we're on the air. So keep that in mind. And if you like a show that would do a whole episode about bulldozers or that kind of thing, please do pay attention.
Bulldozer do?
So much. The doors are super solid. It's got a great sound system. And check out my horn.